Welcome to the deep dive. So we often talk about compute as being, you know, the engine of the cloud. But if compute's the engine, then storage. Well, storage is everything else. It's the fuel tank, it's the cargo hold. Your data is absolutely vital. And knowing where to put it, how to keep it safe, and maybe most importantly, how it affects your bill, that's crucial. Get it wrong, and you're really building on shaky ground.
Absolutely foundational.
Yeah.
And look, for anyone who remembers what it was like before the cloud, storage was a huge headache.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking big, expensive boxes, SANs, storage area networks, NAS devices.
Right.
You had to spend a ton of money up front guessing, literally guessing
right.
how much space you'd need years down the line.
Which never worked out right. Either you bought way too much and half of it sat there gathering dust costing a fortune, or inevitably you ran out. Usually at the worst possible time, like 2 a.m. on a Monday, then it's panic stations trying to get new disks shipped overnight.
Exactly. And that whole nightmare scenario, that's what AWS storage just completely changed. The core idea is elasticity, global reach, and crucially, pay as you go. No more crystal ball gazing for capacity.
Okay, so that's our goal today then. We want to give you the blueprint, essentially. We're going to decode the whole landscape of AWS storage, S3, EBS, EFS, all those different tools. The aim is to give you that clear, practical knowledge you can use right away. Let's start unpacking this blueprint.
Sounds good. But before we even name a single AWS service like S3 or anything else, we really need to get our heads around the three basic ways data gets stored. Everything else fits into one of these buckets, so to speak.
Okay, three fundamental types. Let's walk through them. First up.
First is object storage. Now, this one might feel a bit different from your laptop's hard drive.
How so?
Imagine a massive valet parking service, but for your data. You give them your file, could be a photo, a video, a backup file, whatever, and they give you back a unique ID, a ticket. You don't worry about folders inside folders. It's a flat structure. Your object is the file plus some metadata, and you use that ID, that ticket, to get it back.
And because it's flat, that makes it super scalable, I guess. Good for just huge amounts of unstructured data, like all those photos and videos.
Exactly. Massive scale.
Yeah.
Perfect for unstructured stuff. So that's object storage. But okay, what if you need storage that an operating system can actually use, like to boot from or run a database directly on?
Right. Not just storing files to download later. That sounds different. That's where block storage comes in.
That's block storage. You're totally right. Different concept. Think of it like... Like a huge grid of equally sized boxes or blocks, each with a number. When you attach this kind of storage to a server, the operating system sees it like a raw, unformatted hard drive, just a bunch of blocks it can use.
Ah, so the OS manages the file system on top of those blocks itself.
Precisely. And that direct block access gives you the really high speed and low latency you need for things like databases or the operating system drive itself.
Got it. Okay, so object for massive scale, web access, block for raw performance, OS level access. What's the third flavor?
The third one is probably the most familiar, file storage. This is your classic folders and subfolders hierarchy.
Like the shared drive on a network.
Exactly like a shared network drive.
Yeah.
The key thing here, the big difference from block storage especially, is that multiple servers, multiple computers, can connect to the same file storage and see the same files at the same time. It's designed for sharing.
Okay, the shared filing cabinet analogy. Makes sense. Object, block, file, okay, the basics.
Right. Those are the building blocks. No pun intended.
Huh. Okay, so let's dive into the AWS services themselves. And we have to start with the biggest one, right? The Titan.
You have to start with S3, Amazon Simple Storage Service. It's just fundamental to so much on AWS. It's their massive, super durable, super scalable object storage service.
The magic infinitely deep closet, you called it earlier.
That's a good way to think about it, yeah. Whether you've got tiny files or petabytes of data, S3 just handles it. Application code, documents, backups, website assets, the foundation for huge data lakes.
Yeah.
It all often ends up in S3.
And a couple of key terms people need to know. Your data goes into buckets. And these bucket names, they have to be unique across the entire world of AWS, right?
Globally unique, yeah, that's important. It really underscores that S3 is a global service, not tied to one region in the same way some other services are. And inside the buckets, you have your objects, which are the actual files, plus their metadata.
But the headline feature, the one everyone talks about, is the durability.
Oh, yeah, the durability. AWS guarantees 99.99999999% durability. That's 11 nines.
11 nines. It sounds almost unbelievable. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means, statistically speaking, if you stored, say, 10 million files in S3, you could expect to maybe lose one single file over the course of 10,000 years.
Wow, okay. That's pretty durable. How do they even achieve that?
By automatically making copies of your data and storing them across multiple separate physical data centers, what AWS calls availability zones within a region. It's redundancy built in at a massive scale.
Which explains why it's the default choice for so many critical things. You mentioned backups, disaster recovery, data archiving, even hosting static websites directly from S3.
Absolutely. It's incredibly versatile because of that scale and durability.
Okay, but within S3, it's not just one size fits all, is it? You mentioned cost being a factor. How do we manage that?
Right. So because S3 holds everything from data you need instantly, multiple times a second, to archives you might look at once a decade, they created S3 storage classes. This is all about balancing cost versus access time and frequency.
And this is a really key area for anyone designing systems or even taking an AWS exam, I imagine, getting the storage class right.
Definitely. It can have a huge impact on your bill. So let's start with the default, the kind of main one. That's S3 standard. This is for frequently accessed data, stuff you need fast. It gives you low latency, high throughput. It has the highest storage cost per gigabyte. But accessing the data is cheap and instant. Right. Website assets, active application data.
Right. The prime shelf for your most active data. But what if my access patterns are, well, unpredictable? Or they change over time? I don't want to be constantly moving files between tiers myself.
For that, AWS is something quite clever. S3 Intelligent Tiering. It's kind of the set it and forget it option.
How does that work?
It uses machine learning, basically algorithms, to watch how you access each object. If you stop accessing something frequently, it automatically moves it to a cheaper, infrequent access tier behind the scenes. If you access it again, it moves it back. You get automatic cost savings without lifting a finger.
That sounds pretty useful. Okay, so that handles automatic optimization. What about the tiers specifically designed for data, you know, you don't access often? The infrequent access tiers.
Right, so the main one there is S3 Standard Infrequent Access, or S3 Standard IA. The storage cost per gigabyte per month is lower than S3 Standard.
Cheaper to store. Okay, what's the catch?
The catch is the retrieval fee. You pay a per gigabyte fee every time you access or retrieve data from standard IA.
Okay. So if I store archives there cheaply, but then suddenly need to download terabytes of it,
yeah,
that could get expensive fast.
It could. You need to be mindful. Standard IAs is great for things like older backups or data you need long-term retention for, but don't expect to access regularly. But crucially, when you do need it, access is still fast. Just like S3 standard, you just pay for that retrieval.
Got it. And there's an even cheaper IA option, isn't there? S3 one zone IA. What's the trade-off there? It sounds less resilient.
It is less resilient. That's the key trade-off. One zone means exactly that. Your data is stored in only a single availability zone within a region, unlike the other S3 classes that spread it across multiple AZs.
So if that specific AZ has an issue, power outage, flood, whatever, that data is unavailable and potentially lost if the AZ is destroyed.
Unavailable during the outage, yes. And potentially lost in a disaster scenario affecting that single AZ, although that's rare. So it's much cheaper storage, the cheapest non-archive tier, but you accept lower durability. It's really only suitable for data you can easily recreate if lost, like maybe thumbnail images generated from originals stored elsewhere, or logs you also have copies of. Not for primary data.
Okay, that's a critical distinction. So standard for frequent, intelligent tiering for unknown, standard IA for infrequent but fast retrieval needed, one zone IA for recreatable infrequent data. What about really cold storage, the deep freeze?
Now we're talking about the archive tiers, which used to be mainly under the Glacier brand name. These are for maximum cost savings on data you rarely access.
Glacier.
There's Glacier Instant Retrieval. This one's interesting. It offers the lowest cost storage for data that's rarely accessed. But when you do need it, you need it back in milliseconds, just like S3 Standard or IA. So archive economics, but immediate access.
Right, bridging that gap. Then the more traditional Glacier.
Yeah, Glacier Flexible Retrieval. This is the classic archive option. Very cheap to store, but retrieval isn't instant. It can take anywhere from minutes to several hours to get your data back, depending on what retrieval option you pick.
Minutes to hours. Okay, definitely for archives.
Yeah.
And the absolute coldest, cheapest option.
That's Glacier Deep Archive. Rock bottom storage costs. We're talking fractions of a cent per gigabyte per month. Mm-hmm. But the retrieval time reflects that. You're looking at 12 to 48 hours to get your data back.
12 to 48 hours. Okay.
This is for data you might literally access once every few years. Think regulatory archives that you have to keep for 7 years but probably never look at, or maybe the final backup before decommissioning a system entirely. Long-term, deep freeze storage.
Wow. Okay, that's a whole spectrum just within S3. Standard, intelligent tiering, standard IA, one zone IA, Glacier Instant, Glacier Flexible, Glacier Deep Archive. Lots to choose from based on access patterns and cost.
Exactly. Matching the class to the need is key.
All right. We've spent a lot of time on S3, which makes sense given its importance. But that's mostly storage accessed over the internet, right? Object storage. Let's shift gears. What about storage attached directly to our virtual servers, our EC2 instances, inside the virtual data center?
Right. Now we're moving away from object storage and primarily into block and file storage territory, directly connected to compute.
And the main player for block storage attached to EC2 is?
That would be Amazon EBS, the Elastic Block Store. Remember our definition, high-performance block storage. EBS provides persistent block-level storage volumes for use with EC2 instances. Think of it as the virtual hard drive for your virtual server.
Virtual hard drive. But there's a really important limitation or characteristic people need to grasp about EBS. Isn't there something about location?
Absolutely critical. An EBS volume exists in and is bound to a single availability zone, AZ.
Just one AZ?
Just one. You can only attach an EBS volume to an EC2 instance that is running in that exact same availability zone. It cannot cross AZ boundaries natively.
That's huge for designing resilient applications, right? If that whole AZ has a problem, your EC2 instance goes down, and the EBS volume attached to it is also unavailable.
Precisely. High availability for applications using EBS often involves strategies like replicating data across instances in different AZs or using those EBS snapshots.
Snapshots. How do they work? Are they full backups every time?
They're point-in-time backups of your EBS volume. And the clever part is they are incremental. After the first full snapshot, subsequent snapshots only save the blocks that have changed since the last one, which saves storage space and time.
And where do these snapshots get stored for durability?
They get stored under the hood in S3.
So AWS uses the incredible durability of S3, those 11.9s, as the back end to make EBS snapshots reliable. That's smart.
It's very smart architecture, yeah. So typical use cases for EBS are pretty clear. The boot volume for your EC2 instance, where the operating system lives, or as the data drive for databases like SQL Server, MySQL, PostgreSQL, or NoSQL databases running directly on a single EC2 instance needing that low latency block access.
Okay, so EBS, high-performance block storage for a single EC2 instance in a single AZ. What if I need that shared network drive experience we talked about earlier? Multiple EC2 instances needing to access the same files simultaneously.
Now you're talking about Amazon EFS, the Elastic File System. This is AWS's fully managed, scalable file storage service.
And the key differentiator again?
The key is that multiple EC2 instances can connect to the same EFS file system concurrently. That's the fundamental difference from EBS.
So perfect for things like a fleet of web servers that all need access to the same set of website files or shared application assets.
Exactly. Content management systems like WordPress or Drupal running across multiple web servers, share code repositories, home directories for users logging into multiple machines. EFS fits that perfectly.
And how does it handle things like scaling and availability?
Well, it's elastic, so it grows and shrinks automatically as you add or remove files. You don't pre-provision storage. And importantly, it's a regional service. It automatically stores your data across multiple availability zones within a region for high durability and availability.
Okay, so unlike EBS, which is AZ specific, EFS spans multiple AZs within a region. That's a big plus for availability. Any specific protocols or OS limitations?
It primarily uses the NFS v4 protocol, Network File System version 4. Which means it's primarily designed for and works best with Linux-based EC2 instances. While there are ways to connect from Windows, it's not the primary use case.
Got it. So EFS shared elastic regional file storage mainly for Linux workloads via NFS.
You got it.
Okay, we've covered the big three, S3 for object, EBS for block, EFS for shared file. Are there other more specialized storage services we should touch on, maybe for specific workloads or hybrid setups?
Yeah, there are a couple more worth knowing about, especially for bridging on-premises worlds or handling specific application needs.
Let's hear about the bridge first, connecting existing data centers to AWS storage.
That would be the AWS Storage Gateway. Think of it as a hybrid cloud storage appliance, like a magic portal.
A magic portal. Okay, intriguing.
You typically deploy a virtual machine, or sometimes a hardware appliance, in your own data center. This gateway then connects securely back to AWS, and makes cloud storage like S3 or even EBS volumes appear as if it's local storage within your data center.
Ah, so my old backup software running on my local server could think it's writing to a local tape library or a network share.
Exactly. But it's actually sending the data through the gateway up to S3 for durable, scalable cloud storage. It lets you integrate cloud storage without having to rewrite your existing on-premises applications or workflows. It smooths that transition.
That sounds incredibly useful for migration and backup scenarios.
Oh,
okay, what about specialized file systems?
That's where the Amazon FSx family comes in. FSx stands for File System X, basically. It provides fully managed third-party file systems optimized for specific needs.
Like what kind of specific needs?
Well, the two big ones are FSx for Windows File Server and FSx for Lustre.
Okay, FSx for Windows sounds pretty self-explanatory.
It is. If you're migrating Windows applications to AWS, and those applications rely on a shared Windows file server using the standard SMB protocol and Windows NTFS permissions, FSx for Windows provides exactly that, fully managed. It makes lifting and shifting those apps much easier.
Gotcha. So if my app needs file server share, FSx for Windows can provide that file server share in the cloud.
Precisely. And then there's FSx for Lustre.
Lustre? Never heard of it.
Lustre is a different beast altogether. It's an open source parallel file system designed for extreme speed and scale. Think massive throughput.
Parallel file system. What kind of workloads need that?
We're talking high-performance computing, HPC, scientific simulations, genomic analysis, financial modeling, also heavy-duty machine learning training, or big media workloads like rendering 4K or 8K video. When you need to process huge data sets across many compute nodes really, really fast, FSx or Lustre is often the answer. It's built for speed.
Okay, so FSx for Windows handles the specific needs of Windows shared file systems, and FSx for Lustre handles the extreme performance needs of HPC and similar workloads.
That's the gist of it. Specialized tools for specialized jobs.
Wow. Okay, that was a whirlwind tour through the AWS storage universe. S3, EBS, EFS, Storage Gateway, FSx. Quite a lot to take in.
It is a broad portfolio for sure.
But hopefully we've managed to demystify it a bit. Let's try and boil it down to that quick blueprint for success. When you're faced with a storage requirement, how do you quickly decide?
Okay, the quick decision tree. First, think about the data type and access pattern. Is it unstructured data photos, videos, backups, logs that needs to scale massively and be accessible potentially from anywhere, maybe over the web?
If yes.
That screams S3. Start there. Think about the right S3 storage class for cost and access speed.
Okay, what if it's not unstructured files, but you need a high-performance virtual hard drive for just one specific EC2 instance, like for its operating system or a database running on that instance?
That's EBS. Remember, it's tied to a single instance in a single AZ.
Right, and if you need that shared drive experience, multiple servers, probably Linux, needing to access and modify the same set of files concurrently.
That's your cue for EFS, Shared Elastic Regional File Storage.
And then the special cases. Migrating a Windows app that needs a traditional Windows file share.
Look at FSx for Windows File Server.
And if the requirement is just absolutely blistering speed for something like HPC or massive video rendering,
then FSx for Lustre comes into play.
S3, EBS, EFS. Those are the main three pillars to get right.
Absolutely. And maybe if we tie this back to where we started with durability. Remember, S3 is 11 nines. That comes from AWS managing the complexity of replicating data across multiple physical locations, multiple availability zones. They abstract away the hardware failure for you at that level.
Which is a huge shift from the old days of managing your own ASAN, right? Where one device failure could be catastrophic.
A massive shift.
So maybe here's a final thought for you, the listener, to ponder based on that. If AWS provides that incredible 11 nines of physical data durability with a service like S3, how does that change how you, as an application developer or architect, should think about data safety? Do you still need to build all the same complex application-level checks and redundancy for data loss that you might have done 10 or 15 years ago? Or has the cloud platform itself fundamentally shifted some of that responsibility? Where does the line sit now? Something to think about for your next project.
Definitely something to consider. The landscape has changed.
Indeed it has. Thanks for sharing all that insight today.
My pleasure. Until next time.
Keep diving deep.